Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
Be the size of a cherry or a baseball, a lovely deep red or many other colors, and they put the T in the BLT sandwich. Today on Talk of Iowa, it's Horticulture Day, and we're getting you ready to have homegrown tomatoes that are the talk of the town. Richard Geron and A.J. Nyer are here from Iowa State University, and they'll share with us the best tomato tips. From choosing your cultivar, to prepping the site, to getting the most out of each plant. Then we'll open up the phone lines at 866-780-9100 to answer all of your garden questions. You can also email your questions to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Horticulture Day starts right after this hour's news. It's Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Jason Burns in for Charity Nebbe, and this is normally the time of year where we're getting ready to dig in the garden and maybe think about planting some tomatoes. You may not want to do that this weekend, but we know that the weather will be eventually going our way. And so we have A.J. Nyer here from Iowa State University, who is here to help us talk about tomatoes. Good morning, A.J.
Good morning, Jason.
Richard Geron is also here, ISU Extension. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning.
And when we're talking about tomatoes, there are just so many options that we have that sometimes it's difficult to know where to start. But there are two different main types that we need to focus on. There are determinate plants and indeterminate plants. And it might be good to kind of spell out that difference there. So what is the difference between determinate and indeterminate?
Sure, Jason. So as you correctly mentioned, there are two types of tomatoes based on their growth habit. Mm-hmm. The determinate tomato, if you look at it, the apical meristem, or the top portion of the plant, after a period of time, that apical meristem will eventually end up into a flower, and the growth stops. Whereas the indeterminate tomato, that apical meristem is always vegetative, which means it keeps growing. So indeterminate tomatoes are the ones that, you know, you have to twine them or stake them, and they just keep growing. Mm-hmm. And they die only when the frost comes. Mm-hmm. So that's the main difference. Determinate, after a period of time, stops growth, more bushy. Mm-hmm. Their fruits are more concentrated. Whereas the indeterminate, they just keep yielding, you know, as the plant keeps growing.
So the determinate ones, we don't have to worry so much about them maybe going out of control. But those are ones that do we still want to worry about maybe caging them at all? Or should we just, how should we deal with those?
That's a good question. I think we should consider caging them or staking them in some form or the other. Just because we don't want the foliage of our plants to, you know, touch the soil, the fruits hanging and touching the soil, because that's where most of the pathogens are hanging around. Mm-hmm. And when the soil splashing happens after a rain. So by staking, we avoid that, and we have a better, we get a better quality in terms of the crop load, and also a better health for the plant. So less pathogens. So even though they are determinate, it is always recommended that we either cage them or stake them.
Sure. Sure. So it may not be to control the growth necessarily, but it's just to keep them healthy overall.
That's true.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So anybody who's gone to a farmer's market is familiar with the term heirloom tomato. And it is very much almost a marketing buzzword in some ways, but it has a real meaning in terms of your tomato plant, the difference between heirloom tomatoes and hybrid tomatoes. And so when I'm looking at that and I see that word heirloom, what does that mean?
So heirloom varieties, not cultivars, but varieties, are tomatoes which have been passed down through generations. Mm-hmm. So the seeds have, you know, not been, you know, they have not been crossed like hybrids. We cross and we get the hybrid vigor and we get the hybrid cultivar. These are naturally selected cultivars or varieties that have been passed from generation to generation. So the definition of heirloom may vary depending on whom you ask, but most of the time, no breeding effort in there. They are naturally selected. They are open pollinated, so you're not targeted population is pollination is happening there. So they're open pollination. These heirloom varieties are generally more flavorful more taste to it, more punch.
Ask. Yep.
Yeah, more punch to it when you take a bite into an heirloom. And if you have compared, you know, if you have taken a bite into an heirloom, it just explodes in your mouth, right? You that flavor, that profile is so high. The downside of heirlooms are they are susceptible to more diseases.
Sure.
And pests. They are not like our hybrid types, which are being bred to have, you know, disease resistance and tolerance. But when it comes to flavor, you know, you can't beat them.
Sure. And so that's maybe a good thing to consider when you're picking a plant for your own garden, right? Are you more for the higher maintenance, but maybe higher payoff and flavor kind of a plant, which would be an heirloom, I would guess, versus a hybrid, which hybrids are, you know, when you think about tomatoes that are in the store, basically, a lot of those characteristics were chosen for those plants, not necessarily because of flavor, right?
Yeah. So most of the time, hybrids have been bred for storability. So for shipping purposes, so that you can harvest them at the breaker stage. And breaker stage is the stage when at the blossom end of the fruit, you see a slight pinkish color. That means that the fruit has reached breaker stage and it's going to ripen after that. So these hybrids are harvested at that stage and shipped all across the country. Whereas the heirloom, you want it to ripen on the plant, on the vine, so that it develops all those flavor profiles. And you know, if you leave the plant or fruit longer on the plant, there are more chances of diseases and insects and all getting to it too. So that's the downside. But but the flavor, you know, is amazing.
So if you're really after that tomato flavor of the summer, you may be looking for a good heirloom.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about, you know, picking a plant, because when you go to actually select plants for your own garden, what are you looking for when you're going, you know, at the purchase? What do you want your plant to look like? What are you looking for to bring something home?
Most of our listeners and homeowners, backyard gardeners, would be venturing out soon. As you correctly indicated, not this weekend, but starting the first week of May, venturing out to stores to buy transplants. Tomatoes are grown, are planted, started with transplants. And transplants are about 5 to 6 week old tomato seedling. So when you are at a store selecting your transplant, look for some basic things that portray better health. So, you know, nice foliage, stem, you know, nice stem diameter, thick. Not very lanky and long and falling around. You don't want that. You want to definitely hold the plant and shake it around and see if there are any pests on it. Like, you know, are there any whiteflies or aphids, some insects, free of insects. You should not have any lesions, which can be diseases. So as long as they have been grown well, watered well, and they look healthy and stout, they're good to go.
Very good. We're talking tomatoes right now, but of course it is Horticulture Day here on Talk of Iowa. Talking with Ajay Nair right now. Also, Richard Geron is here in studio. If you want to get your questions ready to go, we do have phone lines open. We'll start taking those phone calls here in just a matter of minutes at 866-780-9100. We were talking about the plants, but you know the other equation is, of course, the soil. You've got to have a site for it. When you're looking to get your tomato plants in the ground, what do you need to do to prep that site?
Sure. For all the vegetables, wherever you plant, they prefer a well-drained soil because, you know, any soil that doesn't drain well will not be able to hold enough, air in it. So the roots will suffer. There could be diseases that could linger there, you know, and the plant would eventually not grow or not be as productive as it should be. So a well-drained soil, preferably good in terms of nutrients. So a soil which you know in the past you've applied compost and, you know, the tilt is better, the soil aggregate stability is better. So any area of your garden where you think the organic matter is high, it's well-drained soil, that's the place you want to plant. In addition to that, light.
Yep.
Oftentimes, you know, we get so much engrossed in the plant and the site and all that, we forget that, okay, maybe after 12 p.m. there is no light at that site. You know, you get only 3 or 4 hours of light. With tomatoes, you're typically looking 6 to 8 hours of light.
Okay.
The more the light, the more the efficiency, the photosynthesis in the plant, and more the vigor and better the crop and the yield and the quality.
Very good. Very good. Okay, so then you get them in the ground, and we talked about this a little bit in terms of what to do after that. But there are a multitude of ways to actually train the tomatoes when you have them in the ground. So what are the differences between those? Because we talked briefly about caging versus staking, but how do you actually train your tomatoes?
Sure.
What's the difference between them?
Yeah, if you don't have many plants to worry about, let's say if you had 5 or 6 plants which are planted 2 to 3 feet apart, I think caging is the way to go. You can buy cages from garden stores, and these cage can each individual cage will sit around a plant. You don't need to clip anything to those cages. You just need to make sure the plants stay within, because they will try to go out of the cage, but you just train them inside. That's mostly for the determinate types. For the indeterminate types, if you usually plant them a little farther, so I would say in a row about 2 feet apart. And in that case, if they are in a line, and you let's say you have 5 or 6 plants in a line, it might be better to put stakes every 2 plants.
Okay.
And these stakes are 5 to 6 feet tall. Wooden stakes would be okay. You put those stakes in, and then you take a twine and go on one side of it and come back on the other side. So you're kind of enclosing the plant within these 2 twines. And you keep doing it maybe 3 or 4 times during the growing season. So each time you put the twine, it's about 6 or 12 inches above the other one, so that you're just keeping the plant straight, and so that it doesn't then lean over. In the case of indeterminate, again, this is more for greenhouses and places where you have something to hang on to at the top. Mm-hmm. You can also put a twine at the top and hang the twine down and connect the plant to it, and the plant will just keep going up on the twine, and you can keep lowering the twine as you go. But that's more of a greenhouse or a high tunnel kind of situation.
Right, right. This has got to be more controlled circumstance than just outside.
Exactly.
Basically. Mm-hmm. Is there a difference in terms of skill for these? You know, if somebody's saying, I want to try my hand at this, and they're listening to our conversation right now, is there one that's more beginner level and one that's maybe more advanced?
Sure. So I would point out to one of the publications which Richard, myself, and Dr. Cindy Haynes have put out. It's on tomatoes. Mm-hmm. It's on the ISU Extension Store. So if you just Google tomatoes on the Extension Store, you'll find that publication. And in that, we do have a diagram. And Lane Jenahan from Extension on Outreach, she helped develop that. That gives a very clear picture of how you should twine. Because oftentimes, we hear about this twining system called the Florida basket weave, in which we are weaving, but we are also trying to follow that DNA double helix model where we are putting the plants between and turning around. I don't think so. You have to do that. You can be simple. Just start with the twine, go on one side with stakes in the middle, and just come back on the other side. So that publication will definitely help. And the caging, it's fairly simple. You put the cage on top of the plant, make sure the plant is centered, and you move the plants, try to pull them inside as they grow up.
Yeah, the twining method seems like there are a lot of people who may have some interesting techniques, but you don't have to treat it like a ballet or anything. You just have to get the job done.
True.
Yeah. So when you're caring for these plants, what are some really good practices to just make sure that you get a good crop and a good high yield out of these plants?
Sure. So the first thing, as you correctly pointed, getting high quality and good quality transplants. When you're buying the transplants, you put them in a site which is well drained, has enough light, has good nutrients in the soil. So probably some compost and fertilizer would help to set things up. You absolutely need to stake them. It could be cage or it could be staking them. I would also recommend putting some mulch around them, and that's because the mulch doesn't allow the rains to splash the soil on the plant. So that way the plant stays disease-free. So all these things and timely harvesting and keeping an eye and scouting your plants for diseases and insects is the way to go.
Perfect. Talking with Ajay Nair about tomatoes, and we are going to take your questions right after this break. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa here on Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Jason Burns, in for Charity Nebbe.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jason Burns. I'm here with Ajay Nair from Iowa State University, as well as Richard Duran from ISU Extension. And we were talking tomatoes. We're also going to take your questions here at 866-780-9100, or you can email us anytime, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. But Ajay, you were saying one other thing we should really mention before we go to the open phones is pruning. Is that right?
That's correct. So tomatoes can get out of hand very quickly because they try to put a lot of vegetative growth. And if you have too much of vegetative growth, then you're losing on the fruit production or the reproductive side of it. So what we recommend is you need to remove the suckers, which arise on the main stem, and they are found in the axil of the leaf and the stem. So wherever the main leaf hits the stem, in that axil, you'll see a new shoot coming up, and that's a sucker. Mm-hmm. So we need to remove the sucker, not all the way, but at least till the first fruit cluster. So in the case of tomatoes, the fruit cluster shows up on the main stem. So until the first fruit cluster comes, we should remove all the suckers underneath that.
Perfect. Okay. Well, and as I've heard it explained to me, you really want to focus the energy of the plant on the fruit as much as possible, and less on the green parts, right?
True. And if you have too much of sucker, the problem is too much of humidity. There could be fungal diseases, bacterial diseases that can linger around. So removing that sucker helps that air movement.
Very good. Well, I think we're going to switch now to taking your calls and emails at 866-780-9100. We have Cecile, who is from Iowa City. Cecile has a question about milky spore and grub control. Hi, Cecile. Welcome to Talk of Iowa.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I would like to know if it's too soon or too late to apply milky spore and how many times a season one should apply it.
Well, unfortunately, milky spore is not very effective. You can apply it, but it just doesn't work as well as, let's say, a chemical insecticide. Now, as far as controlling the grubs, grubs aren't usually a big problem. They may be present in most lawns, but usually the numbers are such that they're not destructive, that we don't really see any damage. So we kind of live with them. Every so often, we do see an area maybe near the sidewalk or maybe the driveway where we have large numbers and the grass turns brown, but that usually is the exception. As far as controlling the grubs and possibly getting rid of the Japanese beetles, that doesn't work. And that's because the Japanese beetles are coming out from various areas, and your treated lawn is just a small speck in the overall landscape. And these are coming from any grassy areas nearby, the neighbors, a park, roadside ditch, whatever. So even if you were to treat your lawn and kill all the white grubs, that's not going to get rid of the Japanese beetles. So unfortunately, that doesn't work either.
Okay, so what should one use?
As far as controlling the grubs, if you want to do that, I would apply an insecticide, and I would apply it typically in late June or early July, right before they appear. But like I said, in most cases, the numbers are such that we can probably get by without doing anything as far as damage to the lawn, because it's not that common.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks, Cecile. Appreciate your call. Let's go now to Bob from Carlisle. And Bob, I understand you're looking for a way to get a good supply of plants, referencing something from maybe a few shows back.
First, we're Griffith Buck roses that are own root. And it wasn't mentioned during the program. This is a place out of Colorado called High Country Roses.
Okay.
Located near Denver, and they have, do have a toll-free number. It's 800-552-2082. And I have purchased roses from them before, and they're very good quality. But they do have quite a few Griffith Buck roses in their inventory.
Right. There are a few companies that do specialize in Buck roses, heirloom roses in Oregon, and the one you mentioned in Colorado. I think there's one or two in Texas, so there are a few where you can where you can get them.
Right. There wasn't mentioned that, so I'd bring it to attention. That's another source.
Okay, great.
Gotcha. Well, thank you, Bob. Appreciate it. Let's go to Marnie in Des Moines. Marnie has a question about azaleas. Marnie, welcome to Talk of Iowa.
Well, thank you. I do. I have an azalea in my front yard that the deer had for dinner a couple of months ago. So I now have blooms on the very top that they couldn't reach, and on the bottom, I guess they couldn't reach either. But so can I prune it down? Will it come back? It's just bare in the middle.
Yeah, I think I would be inclined to wait and see what it does this year. Give it a year. It may fill back in on its own, and I would prefer that if it does. If you're still not happy, then I would prune it next year after blooming.
Okay, and then how would you prune it? Just cut it back, or
I would kind of shape it. I would kind of shape it where, you know, if you have this tall shoot or stem, maybe prune it back by a third or a half, so it's more in proportion to the rest of the plant, so it looks nice.
Okay. Okay.
Are there any suggestions for keeping the deer away?
Basically, fencing works. Beyond that, not much.
All right. Well, good luck, Marnie. Thanks for your call. Carolyn in Ames has a question about mulch. Carolyn, welcome to Talk of Iowa Horticulture Day.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm curious about applying mulch in early spring before the perennials have emerged from the ground. How will that affect their emergence? Is there a better time of year or a better time in the spring to be putting mulch down? Or is there a certain thickness of mulch that will work better?
I actually like doing it usually around mid to late April when all the perennials have come up, but they're not too big yet, so I know exactly where they are. Because I typically don't want to cover the actual spot where they're coming up. I basically put it around the plants, in between the plants. And so in early, well, mid to late April, when the plants are small, I have the room to do that. And I can put it on, typically 2 to 3 inches. And that should work best. I would use wood chips because they're more permanent. They do gradually break down. And so you have to add some periodically. But you can buy various wood chips, and they do a very good job.
So, Carolyn,
thank you,
Carolyn. I'd just like to add, since you are from Ames, the city of Ames provides a free mulch. Now, the quality might not be always good, but in my experience, you know, I have had good luck. It's on 13th Street where they have this big, pileup of different woods which they grind and make mulches. I mean, there's a lot. All they expect is you come with your vehicle, you load your stuff, and you can take as much as you want. It's for free. So you can tap into that as well.
Oh, that's great.
Perfect.
Thank you.
Well, good luck, Carolyn. Thanks for your call. Again, we're taking your phone calls about the plants and garden questions and things that you have in your life for Horticulture Day at 866-780-9100. I'm here with Ajay Nair and Richard Giron from Iowa State University. And Johnny is on the line from Des Moines with a question about tomatoes. Johnny, welcome to Talk of Iowa.
Hey, thanks. Just kind of had a question about, and I'm not sure if you guys would know, but the temperature of the water that we want to keep if we're doing like a aquaponic garden for tomatoes. You guys know anything about that?
So Johnny, and in the Department of Horticulture here at Iowa State, we had a researcher, recently retired, Dr. Dick Gladden, and you know, I have had some conversations with him a few years back about the temperature of the irrigation water. So what he mentioned that definitely the plants do get a shock when they are exposed to colder water, and they will come out of it eventually. But if you're continuously using cold water, he mentioned to me that, you know, it definitely slows their growth a little bit. So as long as the temperature of the water is equal to the room temperature, you know, he said that that's best. You know, if you can maintain that, if you can provide that, that will help the plant to avoid that stress because of that cold water.
Okay, cool. And will tomatoes do well if they have, will they do better? I mean, if they had like a dry period as opposed to a constant water source?
So with respect to tomatoes and other vegetables too, we need to provide a constant source of water, but that doesn't mean that we are watering them and the soil is completely saturated. We want the plants to dry out a little bit, not too much, just a little bit. So typically in the garden, you know, we say an inch a week, but if you, you know, water, let's say on Monday, you know, if it rains, obviously, you don't have to add more water, but if it doesn't, you know, maybe every third or fourth day you should check, and if it's dry, you should add a little bit of water. The reason being, water is critical not only for plant growth, but in case of tomatoes, we often see this physiological disorder called blossom end rot. And in that case, what happens is if you look at the fruit, at the blossom end, you see that black concentric rings, and that's because of calcium deficiency. Not because there is not enough calcium in the soil, but just because the water was not provided in a consistent manner, and calcium moves with water. So if you have inconsistent watering, calcium doesn't move into the plant and causes this blossom end rot. So by managing water, you're not only helping the plant in terms of growth, but also mitigating blossom end rot issues.
Fair enough. All right. Well, thanks for your help today.
You're welcome.
You bet. Thanks for your call, Johnny. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. We also are taking a bunch of email questions right now. talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. One question we had from Bob in Ames says he wanted to know about sweet potatoes, specifically what to do with the vines. He says, should I trim them back or what should I do with those?
Bob, I'm glad you're growing sweet potatoes. You know, I like that crop. It's very nutritious. It's healthy, like other vegetables too. But again, it has some uniqueness to it. I like the flavor and the way you can cook it. It's a long duration crop, as you might have known by now. It takes about 90 to maybe 110 days, so 3 to 3.5 months, sometimes even 4 months. All through this period, the plant is producing foliage. It's photosynthesizing, it's producing compounds, carbohydrates, and other nutrients that it needs for growth, proteins, all that energy, photosynthate is pushed into the root system where it produces the root. So if you take too much of the shoots off, then eventually the yield of the sweet potato will go down, and you might also affect the quality. So I would not, take their vines off, let them grow, let them photosynthesize, capture sun, and turn it into nutrients and food so it can go into the tuberous roots. That being said, I have worked with a few growers or people who have background who are from Southeast Asia. And in that country, the young growth of the sweet potato is a delicacy. You use it to cook. And saute. So if you want to take, a little bit once a while, that's okay. But don't completely strip them off, or don't be too exhaustive when you take the shoots off. That's what I would say.
Perfect. Okay. Solid advice. Hopefully that helps. Angie is calling from West Bend, Iowa, with a question about rhubarb, which means we know summer is on the way. I love rhubarb. Angie, welcome to Talk of Iowa. We may not have Angie anymore. So we will move on then. Maureen in Davenport should have a question about growing plants in a living complex. Maureen, welcome to Talk of Iowa.
Oh, thank you. Yes, I live in a senior citizen complex, and they provide an area for us to have a garden plot. So I have one, a garden plot that's approximately 5 feet by 5 feet, and I would like to grow a compact bush zucchini. Could you recommend one that I can grow?
There are many varieties, not any specific
green,
one. But there are those that have green fruit, those that have yellow fruit. They're basically a bush type plant, and so I would think any variety that you would find locally at a garden center should be fine.
Okay.
I would base it on the color you like, the shape you like, and just go ahead and plant it.
But so, they would be small enough for my little plot.
It should be. They get to be fairly big plants, but they're not vining. So they'll probably take maybe 4 feet of that area. So they'll take most of it eventually.
But
they can also be very productive.
That sounds good.
Maureen, there's a cultivar called Lioness.
Lioness,
yeah. And that's a yellow summer squash. Very prolific yielder. We have used it for many of our projects here, and I have grown it multiple years. So that's a good compact and upright growing plant.
Okay, well, yellow's fine. I like them both. So thank you very much, and thank you for all the help through the years. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thanks for the call, Maureen. Let's go to another email question. This seems like a little bit of an emergency situation to help out with, an emergency horticulture request. From Marion Coon Rapids, she says, I have two healthy hydrangeas, 3 years old and about 2 to 3 feet tall on the east side of my house. Unfortunately, our septic system failed over the weekend, and I had to dig out the hydrangeas to make room for the plumbers to install a new system. Right now, the plants are in my garden shed with a plastic bag protecting the roots. We have been told that we need to wait several months to a year until the dirt settles enough to reseed and replant. In the meantime, what's the best way to preserve my hydrangeas? Should I put them in a large pot outdoors or find a temporary spot in the ground to plant them and then replant next spring? Thanks for any and all suggestions you may have.
I would probably suggest finding a large pot and putting them in a large pot, caring for them during the summer. Then this fall, you can go ahead and plant them. If not, you can even wait till next spring. But if you do that, I would take those pots and set the pots in the ground in the fall so they overwinter well, and then take them out next spring and plant them. So either fall or next spring.
Okay. And good luck with the repairs as well. I know that can be quite a process. Angie, I think, is back from West Bend with her question about rhubarb. Angie, are you there?
Yes, I am here now. I heard you the last time, but you guys couldn't hear me.
Strange. Well, now I think you're coming through loud and clear. So how can we help you with rhubarb?
Well, thanks for taking my question. My husband has MS, and his disease got a little aggravated last summer, so we got behind on some yard work, and our neighbor asked if he could help out, which we were greatly appreciated for. So he was we let him go into the garage and get the weed eater and blah, blah, blah. Didn't think anything of it. One day I was doing dishes and seen him walking around the house with a weed killer spraying. Didn't think anything of it. A few days later, I'm like, oh, gosh, let's have some rhubarb crisps. We're craving rhubarb. Went out to my rhubarb patch. It's dead. I think he sprayed it. We didn't. It all died. I checked it yesterday. Nothing's coming up. Will it come back? If it does come back, is it okay to eat again? I do not know what kind of weed killer he used because I didn't want to hurt his feelings and tell him he killed my rhubarb.
Well, yeah, I would ask what he was spraying. Mm-hmm. I'm not convinced it was what he was spraying. Maybe it was something else. But mm-hmm. I would ask. If it was rhubarb, I mean, if it was Roundup, obviously it could kill the rhubarb. Most of the other herbicides, unless they were sprayed directly, I don't think they would. But I would inquire about that. As far as the plants, only time will tell. If they do come back, I would not harvest this year because that plant needs to recover from the damage. It's been damaged by something, and it needs at least one growing season to recover from that. So if it does come back, then I would not eat anything until next year.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Yep. Thanks, Angie, and good luck with the rhubarb and the tough conversation. Thanks for your call. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can also email your questions, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. It is Horticulture Day. Jason Burns in for Charity Nebbe. We'll be back in just a moment taking more of your questions on Talk of Iowa.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. I'm Jason Burns in for Charity Nebbe. We have full phone lines right now, but if you want to get your question in, we'll try to squeeze you in at 866-780-9100. You can also email your questions anytime, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Let's go to Jaina, who has a question about a tree that is being a little uncooperative. Jaina, welcome to Talk of Iowa.
Hi, and thank you for taking my call. I have planted 2 English walnut trees, same nursery, same planting, same area. One is happy being a tree. The other one, every year, loses the leader. I keep trying to give it a new leader, right, because it ends up growing like a bush. And so I think it's having an identity crisis, but I don't know what else. So I try to choose the strongest branch, right, and have it be a leader. It'll die, and then all these new ones come up from underneath. Any idea, or do I just have a walnut bush?
Well, how big is it at this point? How tall is it?
Its sibling is about 8 feet tall now. It is only waist high.
Okay. I think I might be inclined to pound in a sturdy stake next to the tree and then take what I think is the best branch and very carefully bend it to the stake and then tie it to the stake with some twist ties or whatever, these stretchy things that you can buy at garden centers, and basically choose a leader for the tree. And hopefully it's going to respond to that. And if you have some, let's say, side branches that tend to behave or they want to grow upright or whatever, I would prune them back to kind of inhibit their growth. So hopefully it retains that central leader. So I think I would try to take one, tie it to a support, and force it to have a leader and see if that works.
And anything else that's trying to make it bushy, trim them off.
Trim it back, yeah.
Yeah, trim them back. Okay.
Right.
I will give it a shot. If not, I will just have to accept its identity.
There you go. Well, thank you and good luck, Jaina. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Doug from Rockland City, Iowa, has a question about cherry trees. Doug, welcome to Talk of Iowa.
Hi. I planted two cherry trees, Montmorency, about a year ago. I think it was early May last year. And this year, it hasn't produced any green leaves. When I first planted them, they seemed to establish really well. Okay. They were foliated last summer. But now everything else in my yard is greening up and producing leaves. But
That's a cause for concern. The first winter is always the toughest for any newly planted tree or shrub. So, and we had a very, very cold winter. Okay. So possibly it got so cold that it killed it. That's a possibility. But it may have damaged it, but not destroyed it, and therefore it may leaf out later than normal. So I wouldn't give up on it yet. There's still a hope. If you haven't seen anything by late May, I would assume it didn't make it. But it still has time, so don't give up on it. It may still leaf out.
Keep up the fight. Thanks for the call. Judy in Waterloo has a question about pruning. Judy, welcome to Talk of Iowa.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. We have some mature yew shrubs in several locations in our yard. They're quite woody at the base, but have a lot of nice growth on the top.
Mm-hmm.
I'm inquiring, how can I prune them? If I prune them too low, will I get any green growth? There seems to be a little on some of the shrubs, but I don't know what's the proper pruning method for a quite mature yew to bring it down a little shorter.
Well, with most evergreens, you can't prune them back severely because they don't have the ability to fill back in as far as initiate new growth on bare stems. So things like arborvitae, juniper, you can't do that. You can only prune them lightly. The yews are different.
Okay.
The yews are different. They will tolerate severe pruning where they can initiate new growth from a bare branch. Okay. So if you want to prune them back to the point where you're basically left with bare stems, they will grow again, but it may take them a year or two to grow back and really look nice because initially it's going to be pretty sparse, the foliage. But they have that ability. Now, if you want to do light pruning, that's perfectly fine. They'll look great. But if you want to do fairly severe pruning, it may be a year or two before they look kind of nice again. But they will come back. It just takes time.
Okay. All right. Thanks very much.
You bet. Thanks, Judy. Doris from Ames has a question about boxwoods. Doris, welcome to Horticulture Friday.
Good morning. Yes, we have boxwood across the front of our home, which has a southern exposure. And the first few years, they really flourished. Last year, they didn't look too well, and this year, they just look hopeless. Do they need fertilization that we're not doing?
No, that's not it. Boxwoods are kind of finicky. They're not this reliable, easy-to-grow plant. And winter can be really hard on them, where either the sun or the wind dries them out, because they are evergreen.
Yes.
When that foliage dries out, that can cause some dieback. So boxwoods are a little bit finicky. Sometimes they do well, sometimes they don't.
The ones along the driveway do really well, but the ones up against the home where there's brick behind them have really suffered.
Yeah, they tend to do better if they have an eastern exposure where they get morning sun, afternoon shade. That also affords them some winter protection. They tend to do worse, like on the south side or west side, where they get the hot sun, and also quite a bit of sun during the wintertime. So
What would you suggest for a low-growing shrub on the south side to replace our boxwood?
There aren't very many choices. I think I would probably look at yews. Yews are pretty reliable. They'll grow in full sun to part shade. There are quite a few varieties on that. Make sure you get one that stays fairly low because some of these will get to be 6, 7, 8 foot tall. So make sure you get a variety It stays fairly short.
All right.
The nice thing is the yews can also be pruned easily. They tolerate pruning quite well, so you can do that too. But I would find a variety that stays pretty low.
Okay. Now, how about deer and rabbit damage to a yew?
Well, the deer will eat yews, especially when you have a lot of snow cover. They're nice and green when nothing else is in the wintertime, so they will do that. Rabbits typically don't bother them a great deal, but deer definitely do.
Okay. Well, they didn't bother the boxwood, which was one thing in their favor.
Mm-hmm. Right. They're not very fond of boxwoods now.
Hmm. Well, I guess I'm not either at this point.
That makes two of you, huh?
Doris, we really enjoy your show, and thank you for all your good advice.
Wonderful. Thanks for the call, Doris. Appreciate it very much. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. We've got a question from Jane in Solon about lilacs. Jane, welcome to Talk of Iowa.
Thank you. I have several little suckers growing under my beautiful lilac tree, and I wondered what the chances were if I dig those up and plant them someplace else of having more beautiful lilac bushes. Do they do well usually?
Well, they can. What I would do is go out with a sharp shovel or spade and cut it off because they are coming up from roots of the parent plant. And so I would just dig that up, and I would be inclined probably to put it in a pot initially.
Oh.
And grow it in, and grow it in that pot, care for it for several months, and then maybe plant it this fall when it's bigger.
And, plant it in the fall.
And
okay.
It may not bloom for probably 3 or 4 years, but eventually it will, or it should.
Okay. I'm not sure I have that much time, but I will give it a try. And thank you so much for sharing your knowledge with everyone. I love your show.
Great. Thank you, Jane, so much. Well, I have an email question about tomatoes, which I thought I would try to get to here since we started the hour with talking tomatoes. From Kevin, he asks, would it help to keep soil fungus at bay by laying fabric over the soil and cutting planting holes in it? Or will that is that not helpful?
Yeah. So that's also another way of mulching. You don't always have to use an organic mulch such as switchgrass or straw. You can always use thicker wheat fabric, and in this case, that's what's being done, and punch holes and plant your tomatoes there. Again, you are getting all those benefits of not having the soil splashing on the plant, and that's how you keep septoria and early blight away from the plant. So yes, go for it. That's a good way.
So it's really all about the barrier, right?
Exactly. Yeah, it's a barrier, and these wheat fabrics do allow moisture to go through them, so you're not worried about not having enough moisture in the plant. Mm-hmm. To the plant. I've used wheat fabric for experiments here for my research projects. They are a little bit expensive. But for a smaller plot, smaller area, I think they are pretty reasonable.
That should work well. Okay, great. We have Dee on the line from Ames who has a question about sweet potatoes. Dee, welcome to Talk of Iowa.
Thank you. I wonder what the varieties of sweet potatoes are best for central Iowa.
We have done experiments over multiple years at the Horticulture Research Station focusing on sweet potato spacing and also on sweet potato cultivars. And the ones we recommend are Beauregard, which is a standard workhorse cultivar or variety. So you can definitely go for that. Some of the other ones, Evangeline, it's a variety or a cultivar from North Carolina. It's also easily available online. Then we have Covington. It's also a good variety to plant. Georgia Jet is also another one. So these are all orange flesh varieties. If you're looking for white, Bonita is something which we used this year, and it was okay. I mean, I didn't see much of a demand for white sweet potato varieties here in Central Iowa, but we did just try it. But if you're looking for white, Bonita, but otherwise the ones I mentioned, Beauregard, Covington, Evangeline, Georgia Jet, those are the good ones.
Thank you very much.
You bet.
I sure appreciate your help. Bye.
Yep. Good luck, Dee. Julie has a question in Urbandale. Julie, I understand you're asking about hostas and trying to keep the rabbits away from them. Welcome to Talk of Iowa.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, every year I have some hostas in my backyard,
and the bunnies seem to get them before they get too big. They're starting to pop up now, and I've used that spray before to keep the rabbits away. My neighbor just calls it salad dressing because it doesn't seem to work. So I'm wondering if you can give me any hints on how to keep the hungry bunnies away.
Well, with the rabbits, the repellents sometimes work, and oftentimes they don't, which you found out. As far as foolproof, basically it's fencing, which is not probably what you want to hear, but fencing does work. It could be chicken wire fencing, hardware cloth, and I think they're going to be more of a nuisance in the spring when they're first coming up. Once the hostas get bigger, I think the rabbits are going to leave them alone. So it may be a temporary fence that you...
It's when they're tender and new.
So you may have to put up a temporary fence for a few weeks, and then when they get bigger, the plants, take it off or take it away. So that should work, though.
Great. I'll give it a try. Thanks so much.
Good luck, Julie. Thank you. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. I got a question coming in from, I believe, social media. Robert asks, I would like to plant a lawn of small violets that show up like dandelions in the spring. Some are purple, some are mostly white. Is this a possibility to scatter them throughout my lawn for pollinator help or other insects?
Violets are native to Iowa, and they're blooming right now. As far as a source of seed, I'm not sure about that. They do form a little capsule once they're done blooming, but that would be kind of tedious collecting those and breaking them apart and spreading the seed. So if you could find a seed source, that'd be the way to go.
Okay, very good. Shelly's on the line from Fairfield, has a question about squash beetles. Shelly, welcome to Talk of Iowa.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a small organic garden, and each year I try to grow zucchini and butternut squash, and I grow other things too, which are not a problem, but in particular, the squash gets killed by two types of bugs. One lays eggs under the leaves that look like poppy seeds, and the other one goes to the stem and burrows in the stem, and a lot of times they end up dying. And one farmer from Farmer's Market suggested planting them later. Would that help?
So, yes, planting could help. But again, these insects which you are referring, squash bugs and the squash vine borer, you know, they overwinter here in Iowa. So they are around us. Planting late is a cultural technique which you can use, but eventually if they find them, for example, you mentioned about squash bug, which lay eggs in these clusters under the leaves, like yellow, orange-colored eggs. I don't know how much benefit you'll have by delaying your planting, especially if you have only few plants. You can always put row covers or protect net, some kind of a netting material, as soon as you see them, to keep them away. That's one kind of a mechanical barrier against them. And there are some insecticides that you can use too. Although, you know, with squash bug, you need to be quick. As soon as you see those nymphs coming out, you need to apply that insecticide. Otherwise, you are not able to manage the adult bugs. So insecticides, some kind of row covers would be, I think, a better way to manage them.
Is there an organic insecticide?
Sure. Does neem work?
Yes. So Richard mentioned about neem. Yes, there are neem-based insecticide. Active ingredient is azadirachtin. That's the active ingredient inside neem. So neem would help because it will serve as a deterrent. In cucumbers, this is for cucumber beetles, though, we used a product called Surround, which is actually kaolin clay. So when you spray that over the plant becomes white in color with that clay color, but that acts as a deterrent for the beetles because they don't want to come and chew on that leaf. So that's another technique.
Okay, well, thank you very much for your time.
Great, thanks, Shelley. And I think that is going to do it for this edition of Horticulture Friday. Lots of great questions, so thank you everybody who called in, and thank you to Ajay Nair and Richard Geron. I really appreciate your expertise.
You're welcome.
Enjoy the tomatoes and the vegetables. Thank you.
That's right. And probably, again, steer clear of this weekend for planting. But Talk of Iowa is produced by Emily Woodbury, Caitlin Harrop, and Dennis Reese. Production assistance today from Lulu Dewey and Nick Brinks. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. Don't forget, podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa are available at iowapublicradio.org. I'm Jason Burns, in for Charity Nebbe. Thank you so much for joining us today.